And greetings, everyone.
And welcome again to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, and we're here talking about issues in health, wellness, and alternative medicine today. Glad you can join us and take part of your day to learn and grow and educate yourself in the field of natural and alternative medicine. Remember, you can always get more information on our website, which is drznaturally.com and naturalnurse.com as well, about our fun shops and things that we're doing, and walks and talks and webinars and all kinds of interesting things, our books. So we're going to be talking. Dr. LaPelt is a naturopathic physician, licensed acupuncturist, and Chinese herbalist, a holistic dentist as well, and an expert in biodynamic farming and permaculture, climate change activist, and of course, he was one of my classmates when I was training as a naturopathic physician out in Seattle at Bastyr University. And he's frequently gone to Jamaica with me, and he has studied environmental health science. He went to the University of Pacific Dental School, did a residency in the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, went to naturopathic medical school, and then he has a master's in traditional Chinese medicine at Meiji College, San Francisco, studied permaculture and biodynamic farming for 25 years and had a farm, Still Point Farm Permaculture Center. And now he's doing a lot of work for the Emergency Climate Action Group in Santa Rosa called WECAN. And today's topic is climate change as it affects healthcare, particularly in reference to COVID, a naturopathic holistic perspective. Hey, how you doing, Mike? Great to have you.
Hey, it's good to talk to you. It's been a while. How you been?
Good, good. You sound nice and strong out there. Thanks for getting up and joining us on the program here. So lot about yourself. Talking about holistic medicine, tell me a little bit about your view of holism and how COVID-19 plays a role in that.
Okay. First, with a little levity, somebody, Sage, said that there are two types of people in the world: those that believe there are two types of people and those that don't. And so they're often with deep topics, there's some controversy. The same person said some things just don't make sense. And example would be, why do they have an interstate in Hawaii, an interstate freeway? Or why don't they have Class B batteries? Anyway, those are... just making the point that there is some controversy around this, but what there is not controversy about is that everything that we need, we get from our planet. And it seems like I'm stating the obvious, but often we take it for granted. And we mustn't abuse that gift, otherwise it's at our own peril. And since the industrialized world, has, through its, I call it arrogance, declared man over nature, we've injured our planet, and now it's expressing a fever and a challenged immune system. And yes, every organized structured system has an immune system that repels injury. And in climate change, you know, we're facing a real emergency. Our planet, though, has many elegant systems to bring back this imbalance. And if we don't take heed, we may not survive in the process as our planet re-equilibrates. But the good news is I think relative to COVID, it slows everybody down. And if we could take that time to observe and in particular mimic Mother Nature and her systems, we have some elegant solutions to cool the planet and restore its immune system. And COVID-19, as an emergency, an emerging novel virus, is a reflection of an imbalanced planet. and with less biodiversity, which is often accelerated by climate change. And the good news is that, you know, COVID again has slowed everything down. It allows us kind of to reflect and to connect everything and realize that a disruption in one place has a ripple effect throughout nature and humanity. And right now we're experiencing with less flights, less auto transport, cleaner air, water, less fossil fuel pollution. And it's in a very ironic way is allowing the planet a narrow window to re-equilibrate. But to make this sustainable, as I said before, I think we need to slow down, extract less, give more back to our planet, and allow it to self-heal. And with us as its collaborators. And as naturopathic physicians, our training, one of our primary principles is the inherent healing power of nature. And it's that vitalism thought that goes way back in our history about that power that's above any physical or biochemical entities that we may be able to touch and feel and objectify in this world. So with that, I think that's kind of my opening statement, and now I'll leave it to you with your question.
Sure, thanks. That was awesome. So you mentioned naturopathic medicine, and we know that that is one of the vitalistic types of medicine. And there's some interesting paradigm in naturopathic medicine. We say that the kind of allopathic medicine is more like what we call flat earth medicine versus being holistic. And we have terms in our medicine with calling the terrain is very important and keeping our terrain healthy. So what we're doing is not focusing on the actual virus. We're focusing on healing ourselves and the planet. What's your idea of terrain and ecology in naturopathic thought?
That's a great question. And relative to, it's really important relative to COVID virus, because this isn't going to be the last novel virus. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, why is it appearing? And where do we find it? And how do we deal with it? And in terms of terrain, it's the planet's soil, oceans that really do a lot of the work to keep the planet cool. And as we all know, a lot of the research in climate change is really focused on CO2 from fossil fuel use, which creates basically a blanket in the upper atmosphere retaining heat, as opposed to allowing the infrared radiation to escape the Earth and go back up in the atmosphere. So we're heating our planet. As I said, the planet has a fever. This stresses different systems, and particularly the sacred elements that our ancestors described, the air, the water, the soil, and actually photosynthesis. And when you really look at the terrain, we're really talking about soil health. And today, if you look at industrialized farming, it creates a very acidic soil. The oceans are becoming acidic because of fertilizer runoff and because it's retaining a lot of the CO2. That's the Earth's buffering system for CO2. That's converted and makes the oceans more acidic, which affects wildlife, etc. So we are expression of this planet. We aren't separated from the environment or our planet. So as it's more acidic, our internal environment becomes more acidic. And acidity tends to drive inflammation, as we know as naturopathic physicians. And inflammation is the underlying driving force for all chronic illness. Hence, this novel virus that we see thrives in an acidic environment. It mutates, it replicates, it has to survive with a host. So you need three things for the disease triangle. That is pathogen, the host, and the environment. And if we throw that environment out of balance, we change the terrain, and it invites in different viruses. In addition, when we look at our urban growth boundaries and the movement of peoples on different animal habitats, we're becoming more close in proximity to more wildlife, more animals, and there's a greater opportunity for spillover of these novel viruses, which have evolved with these smaller animals for eons. And a good example is the civet, which is a small animal in China. It harbored the coronavirus from bat, and in the exotic animal trade, a lot of these civets are moved in that animal trade and in close proximity to humans. So that opens up a possibility of increased transmission. So our goal is, as physicians, to change our internal environment so that it's not so acidic. And what we do is we look at nature and mimic those elegant systems to allow that to occur.
So the microcosm and the macrocosm are kind of one and the same, and mirror images of each other, is basically what you're saying there.
Absolutely right. And so that leads us to the point of, you know, we do have this virus. We have to deal with it now. But do we really have to put all our energy into trying to chase this virus down a rabbit hole when we, if we don't change the underlying causes for it, we'll see another novel virus? So it's a bigger issue than that, but it's something that can change. So if you look at a good example is industrialized farming, that's about 25% of the CO2 pollution. And the oceans, as I said, are getting to a point where they're saturated and buffering out that CO2 in the environment. So even if we eliminate all fossil fuels, which we need to do, use alternative forms of transportation, the planet to re-equilibrate will still be emitting CO2 from the oceans for eons. So how do we counteract that blanketing that's heating up the planet? We do it through the soil carbon sponge. And the long and short of it is reforesting, greening our landscapes and landscape management, because we have to rely on nature's hydrologic cycle to really cool the planet. Now, in short, the way that's done is, as we know, plants take in CO2 and give out oxygen that we breathe. Well, that's reducing the concentrations of CO2 in the environment, but we're still pumping it up from the oceans, right? So that CO2 is taken up by plants. It's pushed into the soil. If it's a vital, alive soil, this biodiversity will convert that carbon to a stable form of carbon as sugars, and these exudates move out of the roots into the root hairs, and that feeds this diverse system in the soil. And when plants evapotranspirate and trees, they move moisture up in the upper atmosphere. That is seeded to create rainfall by three ways: through ice crystals, through salt, and interestingly enough, through microbes. Actually, the forests, through their transpiration, the microbes hitch a ride on these droplets. When they get in the upper atmosphere, the sun breaks down the cell wall, and that creates a nidus or a nucleation to condense this moisture to form rain clouds, which drop down on the soil. And if it's alive, it's nice and porous, and it sinks in, rehydrates the soil, and that cycle continues. So with 1 gram of carbon retained in the soil, we hold 8 grams of water. So by greening our surfaces and in our design of houses, we use permeable surfaces so water can filtrate down into the soil and rehydrate. We have a natural way to cool the planet while we're dealing with reduction in CO2 concentrations.
What are the biggest sources of CO2, Dr. LaPelt? There's some controversy. You know, some people think it's eating beef, and other people think it's fossil fuel, and there's many other theories. And then, of course, there are naysayers that say that none of this is really happening. So what's your comments on that?
Well, that's really a great question. And I think it gets down to how you farm. And if you look at animal farming, most of it's industrialized with crowded conditions. They use a lot of antibiotics. So these animals their immune systems are stressed, and they're more likely to pick up diseases just like you and I. A good example is the swine flu. Hogs in crowded conditions, fed unnatural foods that are nutrient depleted, and that creates a susceptible host. And then if you have farmers interacting, you have spillover, etc. So it's an issue of how and why. For example, carbon is not the problem. It's where it is held. If it's held in the soils and they're vibrant and alive, we can draw down concentrations in the atmosphere and cool the planet through the hydrologic cycle that I was talking about. In terms of animals, their main source of that blanket, if you will, that covers the planet is methane. Also, the tundra, which is starting to melt, is another great source of methane, and it actually hangs around in the atmosphere 100 times longer than CO2. So if you do integrate animals in a living system without crowded conditions, rotate them from different plots, you actually encourage a biodiversity in the soil through their poop that they push into the ground, and that system is in balance. But when we crowd animals, we feed them improper food, that is the problem. When you do it in a sustainable way, actually, as they're pooping and tromping down that compost, if you will, into the soil, it actually creates hydroxy radicals, which counteract the methane, which is the problem from a lot of animal farming. The second thing, as we all know, is deforestation. You know, if there's a high demand for meat, and like in Brazil, they're cutting down the Amazon rainforest to graze animals. And we need to keep those forests. Those are the major players in cooling and keeping the hydrologic cycle going. So it's the number of animals, and it's how we farm them.
And how do we know that all this is true and with climate change? I'm just being devil's advocate from the naysayers that say that nothing's happening. Or they may say that something's happening, but maybe it's not humans that are doing this. This is just like a natural cycle or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's take the second part of your question. If it's a natural part of the cycle, we're still in it. And we as humans, if we don't address it, whether it's a natural cycle or not, we may not be here. The Earth will survive. It has elegant systems to re-equilibrate, but we're a little more fragile. So that's the one piece of it. In terms of, you know, is it true or not? All we have to do is observe and look at, you know, Greenland, look at the ice sheets, look at the extreme storms, the climate extremes of flooding, the fires out here in the West, which, by the way, dump more carbon into the atmosphere. So climate change is creating a lot of extremes. We can either look at it and deal with what's going on, or let it go to our children and their children, who will very likely have very extreme adaptation. They'll need strategies to really adapt. And whether they survive is questionable if nothing is done.
Like you were saying, that New York will probably be, parts of New York will be underwater in Florida in 25, 30 years or so.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, developing oceanfront property is, in my view, not good investment. You know, I prefer doing it more inland, but we need a forward-thinking strategy and bold ideas. And again, if this COVID is an opportunity because it's slowing us down, we have ways to look at things a little bit differently. And if we observe, keep our eyes open, nature is telling us and giving us tools what to do. And Hunter Levins, who runs the Rocky Mountain Institute in Colorado, is in a lot of research on biomimicry and using the elegant systems of nature to really make substantive changes on all levels in terms of climate change, food production, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it gets down to our local areas, and we each need to get familiar with our watershed, because our watershed creates a community of commonality with nature. The water flow, where it flows, fertility of soil, air quality. So again, you know, looking at the sacred elements, the air, the water, the soil, and photosynthesis, and looking at ways to optimize that. And we have the solution. We just need the political will to really get this movement going. And the good news is in California, there's a movement, and actually there's funding for farmers and education to do carbon farming, which talks about what I just talked about. And that is retaining carbon in the soil and avoiding external inputs. If you look at farming, 50% of their costs are in external inputs like fertilizers and biocides. And if we want a living soil, we need to nurture that carbon soil sponge to create biodiversity, green our landscapes, and integrate animals in a balanced way with trees and understorage coverage and moving them in different locations. And that's the way we restabilize the soil, which can be up to 90% of our solution for cooling the planet.
If you're just joining us, we're here with Dr. Michael LaPelt. We're talking about the intricate interplay of nature and the carbon cycle and the water cycle and the health of the soil and the health of us. And as we look at our own immune resilience and the resilience of the planet to hopefully help stop global warming. So now let's get back to us as naturopathic physicians. We're always looking at, you know, we're chasing the rabbit hole. We're chasing the potential vaccine for these zoonotic infections, but that's not really the naturopathic idea. We want to assess immune resilience. So there are ways that we can actually do those things for patients. Of course, they're not being looked at, and I rarely read about this in the mass media, just programs like ours, you know.
It's true, and that's where we need, as naturopathic physicians, a bigger voice and a voice at the table, because we have elegant strategies to deal with this imbalance and to really enhance immune resilience. Because, yes, we have a novel environment in virus. Yes, we need to pay attention to it, but it's about immune resilience. Look at the folks that have been most affected by COVID-19. By and large, poor communities, less access to healthy food and preventive care, living in more crowded conditions. And this really invites in a pathogen who needs a host to survive. And as naturopathic physicians, we have real simple ways to assess what is immune resilience. And one of my friends, Dr. Bajani, who owns Immuno Labs, I was talking to him, and he said, you know, it's fine to check PCR levels to see what the viral levels are. That's good. It's also somewhat of a benefit to check for antibodies, IgG and IgM, to see if you're building antibodies to the virus. However, those tests can be wildly inaccurate. And he said a simple way to check basic immune resilience is secretory IgA. And that is kind of the first line of defense that lines all our mucosal tissue in the body. Where's COVID enter? Through the nose, mucosa, and it migrates through the body. So a simple saliva test could measure IgA levels. Secondarily, we could measure natural killer cell lymphocyte status, mm-hmm. and CD4 and CD8 ratios. And that was done during the HIV epidemic, and that really helped control the HIV virus, is looking at these parameters. And if your CD4 and 8 ratio is over 2, that's probably indicative of a strong immune system. So what do we do as naturopathic physicians? You know, we step back and we look at the big picture and we ask, well, why is this person sick? Is it their daily life? Is it their diet? And as naturopathic physicians, that's the core of our training. So we need to talk about food. And if we talk about food with our patients, we need to talk about where it's grown and how it's grown. And with climate change, over the last 40, 50 years, since World War II, or 70 years, the nutrient density of food is diminished because plants are more stressed with a hotter surface, high heat events, that they're trying to survive. So they're fruiting less, and the food density is less. So that gets you back to really that regenerative farming, increasing the soil carbon sponge, so that diversity in the soil is vital, and we can increase that food density. So that's number one, looking at diet and lifestyle. What we can do for the moment for COVID, for example, to enhance immune resilience, or use things like colostrum, vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, and N-acetylcysteine, antioxidants, immunomodulators like ashwagandha, maca, American ginseng, melatonin. And we don't just throw those things at patients. We take a history and find out which is going to benefit that patient the most. And if what's really interesting is conventional medicine in hospitals now that are very overwhelmed with COVID patients have done what they know how to do, and that's to use their conventional medicines. But that's not really affecting morbidity and mortality to a great degree. Right now, as we speak, Houston is overrun, all their hospitals, and they're starting to use a cocktail that has hydrocortisone, high doses of vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin A, and zinc, and they're starting to see the morbidity go down, hence less time in the hospital, and mortality rate go down. So it's very inexpensive. Again, those items that we use, you can't patent them, so there's not a motivation for pharmaceuticals companies to really get involved in this. So we have very elegant, simple things to do. Now, let's say you have the COVID virus, you have the symptoms. You're starting to have respiratory symptoms. There are novel things that we can do as naturopaths. Have a patient get a nebulizer. Have them nebulize glutathione. That's a great antioxidant that lines all the mucosal membranes of the lungs and the nasal passages. We could use 3% hydrogen peroxide and nebulize that. We can use medical ozone and high doses of vitamin C if we're taking it oral to bowel tolerance, because our needs, depending on our stress, vary. So So you may take 5,000 micrograms. Next person might need 10,000 micrograms. Until you take it until the stool softens and you back off of it, and that's to bowel tolerance. So those things have really been our tried and true through eons of naturopathic medicine. And therefore, I'd like to see, as I said before, a bigger voice for us at the table to really work with this virus, because it's going to be with us. So what do? We enhance immune resilience as we move through this. We're changing the terrain such that it can't survive. So
right, we're not treating the actual virus. We're emboldening the patient so that they can fight their own battle. That's very critical, because there's naturopathic doctors and other nutritional companies that are getting letters from the FCC and FDA saying, oh, you can't make a claim and you're not supposed to go after the virus. But we're actually treating the person that has the disease, not the disease the person has. That's a really interesting philosophical construct in vitalism.
Absolutely. And to your point, the National Health Service in Great Britain is giving a vitamin cocktail, a lot of what I mentioned, to their health frontline workers, healthcare workers, for free. Scotland is doing it. Ireland is doing it. A lot of European countries have done it because it's low cost and it's very helpful. Because, again, as you said, we're not treating the virus per se. We're enhancing immune resilience that then can deal with this virus, break it down, and excrete it. Because this is not the last novel virus. So our only strategy has to be to enhance immune resilience. And that's what ties it in with the planet and climate change, is that, with the soils changing, the vitality and the oceans, et cetera, we are expression of the environment. We are not separate. And that really, this story of separateness, I think, is a core issue, not only emotionally, particularly in this COVID instance, but it's been kind of our culture for eons. And that's the old story. I'd like to call that the old story of separation. The new story, I believe, is in naturopathic tradition, and that is the interconnectedness of everything, and that everything has value, and that diversity is the key. Diversity in the soil, diversity among plants, diversity in our communities, in our states, in our nations, and in the world, actually enhance survival. And it's done through cooperation and collaboration. So I think that we can't separate out our medicine without talking about the climate. And as naturopathic physicians, I think we're poised to have that conversation, because our core tenet is the healing power of nature, and vitalism, or the vital force, which all ancient cultures, by the way, talked about. We're kind of just reinventing the wheel. Prana in East Indian medicine, Qi in Chinese medicine. Natives had their higher source of vital force and energy. So that's, really the key. And I think part of what this says is, if you look at it, COVID is the quiz and climate change is the final exam.
Interesting. That's a great place to take a quick break. We're going to play our natural medicine chess. Everyone get a cup of tea. When we get back, we're going to talk about not only how climate change affects our health in other ways, but also things that we can do about it at a local level. That's where Dr. LaPelt is working with the Working Group for Emergency Climate Action now in Sonoma County. There are things that we can do at a local level to support this change. And when we change locally, it permeates, and we could change globally. So let's play that natural medicine chest and stay with us.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the essential oil taken from the Australian tea tree.
The tea tree, known as Melaleuca alternifolia, grows in only one region of the world, the northeast corner of Australia. It is a full-sized tree of the myrtle family, whose oil has powerful abilities to clean and help heal wounds and skin ailments such as cuts, burns, and rashes. In 1770, the infamous Captain Cook was a lieutenant in the British Royal Navy when his ship landed in Australia. The botanist on board, Sir Joseph Banks, collected samples of a sticky aromatic leaf and brought them back to England for further investigation.
In 1923, an Australian curator and chemist, Dr. Penfold, conducted a study on tea tree leaves and discovered that their essential oils are 13 times stronger as an antiseptic bactericide than carbolic acid, considered the standard in the early 1900s. The oil contains 50 to 60% terpenes, 6 to 8% cineol, which causes its camphor-like odor, and several kinds of alcohols. In 1933, the Australian Journal of Pharmacy, the American Journal of the National Medical Association, and the British Medical Journal reported that tea tree oil is a powerful disinfectant, non-poisonous, non-irritating, and has been used successfully in a very wide range of septic conditions. Australian tea tree oil is mentioned in the British Pharmaceutical Codex of 1949, the UK Medicine List, and the Dispensary of the United States.
During World War II, tea tree oil was considered a standard issue item for all first aid kits for Army and Navy units in tropical regions. The demand for tea tree oil exceeded the supply. However, after World War II, synthetic drugs gained in popularity and the use of tea tree oil in medicine waned. In more recent times, a renewed interest in natural, non-toxic alternatives has triggered a resurgence in tea tree oil research. In 1985, Dr. Paul Belacher, chief of the phytotherapy department at the Faculty of Medicine, University of Paris, worked on several double-blind studies involving tea tree oil and its application as a remedy for candidiasis, chronic cystitis, staph and strep infections, and nail bed fungus. He stated, and we quote, "The essential oil of Melaleuca has entered the team of major essential oils and emerges as an antiseptic and antifungal weapon of the first order in phytoaromatherapy."
Try a few drops of tea tree oil in a steam vaporizer and inhale for blocked sinuses, or rub the oil on chest and back for a cough. The Australian Journal of Dentistry reported that using tea tree oil in dental hygiene and in surgery showed it to be an extremely effective antiseptic. Add a drop on your toothbrush or include it as a gargle and mouthwash. Tea tree oil can be applied directly to the skin. Although it's possible that some people may experience a mild allergic reaction, in-depth research has shown tea tree oil to be non-irritating and safe.
So, listeners, think about including tea tree oil, the first aid kit in a bottle, in your natural medicine chest.
And thank you for that natural medicine chest. That was really appropriate, being a holistic dentist, Dr. LaPelle. Welcome back on tea tree oil.
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, that wasn't planned. That was just serendipity. So it's a good, powerful plant. Our essential oils are powerful allies. But like you mentioned, who knows if changing the soil dynamics would change the phytochemistry of the plants. That's basically what you're saying, is when we change, when the soil weakens and when we get these changes in the carbon cycle, that changes the phytochemistry of the plants, whether the plants are food or medicine, and that can impact our health tremendously. You know, I do a lot of work with, as yourself, with looking at patients' nutrition, and I'm seeing a lot of folks that, you know, seem to eat, you know, organic food and good food, but their nutrients are very, very low in their body. So I think this is definitely happening at a global scale. That's for sure.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Good, good, good. Okay. Yeah, so let's move into what are you working with as far as taking local action for helping remedy the Earth's challenges and our own immune challenges that we face as a society?
It's a great question, and I think it gets down to, you know, talk is cheap and we need to do something. And what I've found since I've become really active with the climate change movement is that action really helps mitigate despair and fear, because certainly we all have enough negativity around us and we're feeling isolated and that brings me to this, the messaging. Social distancing, I think, should be physical distancing with social interaction, because I think that words matter, and that really makes us think more of isolation and separation. And there's a lot of emotional stress going around. And in terms of what we're doing locally, we really, health is a big part of what we're looking at in terms of climate change and because of the cost of health. But if we look at each of our local communities, that empowers us to make changes in our local communities. Adjacent communities look at that, they start to do this, and it's going on, and it kind of leapfrogs. So in our county, I'm working with a Working Group for Emergency Climate Action Network. And what we did was we stepped back and we looked at what are the major factors in our locale that are affecting climate change. And we're a very agricultural county. So the first thing that came up was transportation. That adds up to 25 to 30% of the CO2 emissions. So that's one of our focuses. The second focus is in agriculture. Fortunately, in our county, we have a lot of progressive farmers that are doing permaculture, biodynamic farming, forest reforestation, agroforestry, all sorts of things that regenerate the soil, carbon farming. And then we looked at, you know, the third part of that, and that's in terms of waste. Waste is a big factor in terms of what you take to your dump, how it decomposes, and what it throws up in the atmosphere. So those were we call it the low-hanging fruit. So what do we do about transportation? Our goal is to get more people out of cars, because most of our trips are short distance. So we're really working on a movement to open up streets, have separated bike paths, and encourage more rapid transit through free transportation and more accessible time schedules. We have a train that goes down to the Bay Area. We have a bike path that goes 77 miles unobstructed. So that's a north-south corridor, and we're connecting municipalities in our county to that north-south line for cyclists to ride their bikes. And we're closing down streets to optimize bicycling for utility purposes and getting all levels and all ages out, because the way it's designed now, our systems and bike lanes are really unsafe. And if you look at the history of Europe, they've really incorporated biking as a major way to get around in urban areas to work, et cetera. And that has a huge impact on our health, because we're out exercising, we enjoy it, and we don't have to worry about getting in and out of our car, and it saves the environment. So we've been working a lot with getting funding for separated bike paths. And there is, if you look around, there is a huge movement all over the planet to get more people out on bicycles. The sales of bikes have soared, and electric bikes are a huge issue, particularly for elderly. They can get on these bikes and ride any terrain with these bicycles. So that's our main source that we're working on now, is to open up streets that go to the downtown so people can ride their bikes to shop and not be in competition with auto transport. So those are the main things that we're looking at. Underneath this, as in the COVID and in healthcare, we really need to look at equity, because diversity is such a key in terms of input and moving this forward to bring everybody along. And Van Jones, who was in the Obama administration, he's from Oakland, California, just south of us here. He developed the Dream Corps, which is a lot of folks from the underserved community getting involved in solar installation, doing a lot of things that create jobs and purpose in underserved communities so that they can really be a part of our solution. And so that's one of two or three things that we're doing right now that are really making a change. And in terms of farming, as I said in my bio, I had a biodynamic permaculture farm for 25 years. And what it taught me was more about medicine, actually, than medical school. Because if we slow down and observe, we watch Mother Nature do its elegant strategies for balance and keeping its immune system strong. And we can do the same by really following Mother Nature's cues.
What about folks that are very, you know, real urbanites? They could certainly start growing their own food and change empty lots into, they may have to mitigate the lead and heavy metals that have deposited in the soil over many years, generations, but they could certainly do that. And that would help with the food deserts that we see all around the urban areas.
Absolutely. And urban permaculture is really, really a simple, elegant strategy for that. And back to your mitigation of heavy metals, again, where do you see it? Often in poor communities. Industries have dumped toxins there. Again, nature has an elegant way to really biosequester these toxins. And one of the best ways to do it is through mushrooms. If you read Paul Stamets' book, Mycelial Running, he talks about how to mitigate heavy metals and solvents. And, you know, he's done it through mushrooms. So what you do, for example, for heavy metals, is the mushrooms draw up these concentrations. You take them to a decomposing industrial plant and extract out the heavy metals and recycle them. And so that we clean that soil up and begin the process of doing urban permaculture, where we enhance that soil carbon sponge, and you can get community involved. You share the excess of food production. And it could be something as simple as a raised bed in your tiny backyard, growing herbs, growing a few vegetables. And we're seeing an upsurge of that with COVID. We had shelter in place here in California for 3 months. People are out in their gardens. It's good therapy. It's great exercise. They're involving their children and growing things. It's like the Liberty Gardens during World War II. So, again, there's always a silver lining in something ugly like the COVID, but that's purely a symptom of an imbalanced planet. And what we can do locally is empower ourselves and our local community. And through our elected officials, local officials, we can really make them start to make bold choices and really do what we need to make this right.
What are some climate organizations that folks could look up and start researching? Hopefully our conversation is great fodder for further research on by our listeners so that they can start the process of taking local action, even in their own lives. I mean, this is where it starts. It starts with your own life, consuming maybe less beef, growing organic, maybe learning about permaculture and understanding these dynamics. So I know that there's a lot of climate organizations that folks can, get in contact.
Yeah, and just to mention a few, once you get in, check the links out, it will be just abundantly clear that there's more going on than meets the eye and all over the world. And just some of the few, you know, out here in California, we have Healthy Soils California and Carbon Farming California, where the state is actually giving grants for farmers to do conversion to carbon sequestration. And that simply means less external inputs, you know, fertilizers, biocides, which run off, get into our streams, ultimately get into the ocean. We have a farmers guild, and they're all over, you know, the United States. Permaculture Association, the Biodynamic Demeter Association, that's an organization that certifies biodynamic farmers. And biodynamic farming is basically, you know, regenerative farming and integrating animals and soil and plants and forests in the same system that's diverse and balanced and not overgrazed. And they talk about the celestial bodies and how they impact the fruiting of the plants. Gives you ideas of when to prune. For example, I had grapes on my farm, and you prune them when you have a descending moon, when the fluids are held in the roots, so when you clip the canes, you don't leak vital fluids out. And you harvest the fruit when you have an ascending moon, when it's like gravity pulls all those fluids and juices to the fruit. So that's an ideal time. So they looked at the big picture of the influence of, you know, the moon and gravity, and tides aren't just in the oceans. They're in plants and they're in our bodies. That's why at full moons, our physiology is different. And if you look at seasonal changes, when CO2 concentrations increase in the fall and winter and decrease in the spring and fall and summer, and why is that? Plants are leafing out. We're getting more evaporation. We're getting more carbon sequestration from this new leafing and driving the carbon into the soil. So it's that elegant system of balance. And the Land Institute of Salina, Kansas, by Wes Jackson, he's a really innovative farmer, and he's now working with a Kernza root, K-E-R-N-Z-A. And these plants have a root that is 12 feet long. What that does is that holds that soil to that depth. It creates a diverse community, so you have healthy soils that go down 12 feet. And this has been, there's actually an organic beer company in Oregon that's making all, using the grain Kernza to make their organic beer. So there are many organizations, and a couple others that I want to leave you with is bioneers.org, B-I-O-N-E-E-R-S. And it's a wonderful yearly meeting that happens in south of me in San Rafael, California. But they live stream all over the world, and their whole take is on solutions. And we do have the problems, we've identified them, but it's about solutions. So you walk away feeling like, yeah, I can do something at my local level.
Right. Yeah, that's what it's all about there. And some good books. I know you talked about the book by Warren Andaman, MD, about animal viruses and humans, a narrow divide. That might be a good book so that people could learn more about COVID and that, you know, this is a symptom. You know, naturopathic doctors always looked at symptoms as positive things, not negative things always. They were kind of positive things. So they kind of turned it around and said, well, this is the body's response to some morbific influence, as they used to say in the old days. So this is all positive things in a way. We just have to kind of turn it around. We've been living in fear, and fear is a toxin, I think. I believe it's actually might even be worse than a virus. What's your thoughts on that, Dr. Patel?
Absolutely. And if you look at our planet, warming, desertification, more arid lands, less green, all this, and the virus included, is a symptom of imbalance. And if we stand back and pay attention, then we can make changes. But this is a wake-up call, and it's asking, Mother Earth is asking us to help her. And we can do this together if we do it collaboratively in an equitable way. Also, permaculture started in the 70s in actually Australia, and they have some really innovative ideas around the hydrologic cycle and climate cooling. There's a wonderful microbiologist who has the big picture. His name is Walter Jehne, J-E-H-N-E. He's done a lot of YouTube educational things, and he's really worth checking out because he really describes that hydrologic cycle and how carbon farming is really turning deserts in Australia to living systems of greenery. And they're really the canary in the mine in Australia. They've seen the impacts of climate change very early on. And they, like us in California, are getting more and more wildfires. And so cooling the planet, increasing the vitality of the soil is a simple, elegant way to really mimic Mother Nature. So that's, as you said, I think it's really beautiful that, you know, symptoms are simply an internal message that we're out of balance, and it's no different with the planet.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. So folks can reach you at your email. I know that's eclecticdrdr@gmail.com. And I think you have a website too.
Yes, stillpointhealthcare.com.
Okay, stillpointhealthcare. Dr. Michael Appel, boy, I tell you, took us through a beautiful journey of connecting the world and the globe and Gaia Earth with what the heck's going on with COVID. Who knew? And that's great to see that connection. Thanks so much for sharing your wisdom with us.
Great to talk to you, Dr. Z.
Okay. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay healthy, folks, because health is wealth. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.